Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
This afternoon, we'd like to talk about the UFO phenomenon. Usually, in my slide talk, when I deal with this matter, I give a set of three prepared audio visuals done by Professor Alan Hynek at the Northwestern University in Chicago. But this would not be possible for an audio tape like this, since his material is already copyrighted, and since, of course, he uses a number of visuals that would be helpful in that direction. But basically, I'll give you a summary of the type of material he presents, and then after that presentation, we'll go into looking at a Christian perspective on this whole matter of UFOs. The material, then, that I'll be using is a summary of work done by Dr. J. Alan Hynek, Professor of Astronomy at Northwestern University in Chicago, who is also presently director of the Center for UFO Studies in Evanston, Illinois. Dr. Hynek has a rather unusual background in that he has thorough training in astronomy, and on top of that, for over 20 years, he was consultant with the U.S. Air Force's investigation of UFOs under the names Project Sign and Project Blue Book. Well, let's have a look then at the type of material which we'll find done by men who are studying UFOs and trying to figure out what is going on. First of all, an investigator is faced with a large number of UFO reports of various strange things that have occurred, and they're faced with trying to analyze these. The name UFO means unidentified flying object, but after these reports have been looked at, we find that in most cases where a thorough investigation can be done, the object is later identified. It becomes an IFO, an unidentified flying object. Part of the problem here is that there are many people out there that are not aware of some of the rather strange-looking things that go on that are actually not UFOs in the real sense at all, not flying saucers anyway, but which are rather strange weather phenomena or things of this variety. So when UFO reports are analyzed, we find that the majority of the cases reduce to things that are known. However, we do find a rather substantial residue that seems to defy any simple explanation. The two types of problems we have here in sorting UFO reports to try and decide what are really unidentified flying objects, that is, things that after examination by experts still are unidentified, and what are merely flying objects that weren't identified by the observer, there are two problems here. One of them is the sincere observer who misidentifies some ordinary phenomenon. There have been cases where persons have seen clouds which they thought were UFOs, some rather unusual sorts of clouds, perhaps a noctilucent cloud, a cloud that glows at night, rather rare sort of cloud, but they do occur, or what are called lenticular clouds, clouds that stay put in a particular location rather than drifting across the sky because some object on the ground, maybe a mountain or something of that sort, produces this particular type of cloud. Balloons have been misidentified for flying saucers. The Weather Bureau used to use a great deal of the weather balloons, and now, although the Weather Bureau is not perhaps doing as much balloon flying, there are a lot of hot air balloons which people are flying around in, and I've occasionally seen those myself. They're rather striking when seen, but if you're close enough, you can tell what they are. Airplanes have sometimes been misidentified for UFOs, not obviously when they're close enough to see what shape they are and to hear their motor and such, but often when they're far away or reflecting the sun or seen at night or something of that variety. And of course, meteors, shooting stars, can be mistaken for UFOs on occasion. And believe it or not, the planet Venus has been mistaken for a UFO on a number of occasions. It is really rather bright, and sometimes on a clear night, just as it's rising above the horizon or something, can be mistaken for a UFO. In fact, it's even been mistaken by air traffic controllers for an airplane, or on one occasion by a railroad engineer for a train coming down his track, because it happened to be rising right where the track went over the horizon. So those sorts of things can happen. Sincere observers misidentify some sort of ordinary phenomenon. On the other hand, you have a different type of observer that's a problem, and that would be an observer who is actually a hoaxer, a person who is trying to put one over on somebody or another and gives a report that the person knows is false, or he even goes to the trouble of faking a photograph of some variety. Such people do exist, And some people will do these things when you really would not expect it. We know they exist because there are people who have later confessed that they did something of this variety. Well, so we have all these UFO reports coming in. Some of them doubtless will be misidentifications by sincere observers, and some of them will be hoaxes by persons who are fraudulent for various reasons, perhaps not for any real malicious reason. But the question really would be, can you remove those from the reports coming in? And if you do, do you find anything left? Well, question then would be, how would we detect these different types of observations that are not really UFOs? Well, in the first case, where you're a sincere observer misidentifying some ordinary phenomenon, you would try to detect those by getting as much information as possible on where it was observed, exactly when it was observed, what direction it was observed in, was it moving, how fast was it moving, how long did the observer see it, and things of that variety. And occasionally you can then say, well, we do know that the planet Venus was rising in that direction at that time, and since you say you saw it for 10 minutes before you went in the house or before a cloud covered or something, it didn't move noticeably, or it seemed to move a little bit, but not so much that might not be your imagination, which does occur occasionally with a light in a dark sky without anything to check against, then one might be inclined to say, well, that was Venus or something like that. Or if it moved very rapidly across the sky, so it's across the sky in 2 seconds, bright light, and it was happened to know that that's a period when meteor showers are going on as they occur at certain times of the year, then indeed we might say, well, that was a meteor which was observed, or it might have been a meteor, something of that variety. Whereas certain other types of movements don't fit meteors, they don't fit Venus, and they don't seem to fit airplanes either, but you can see there's several things that are available there. Basically, what one would want to do is find out enough about what happened and then check with airports on where planes were flying and things of that variety. And quite often that can be done and show, well, this definitely is not explainable by anything we can think of, or this is explainable by certain things we can think of, and probably it was one of those, even though we might not be able to tell for sure. You can see that this method is not foolproof, but at least you're able to remove some things that are rather likely to be simply explainable. The problem of hoaxers is a little different. There, you would try to get as much background as the person as you could. Is he the kind of person who does things like this? If the person is provided a photograph, that's not very common, but there are a number of photographs that have been made of alleged UFOs, then it's possible to, with some money being spent, run tests on these photos. There are no tests that can be run that can absolutely guarantee that something is not a fraud, or absolutely guarantee probably that something is a fraud, but there are some tests that work rather well. One of the most important of these tests would be checking the focus of the object that is alleged to be the UFO with the focus of anything else that may be in the picture. Perhaps there are tree branches, a house, something of that variety. It's often possible to show that the object, the UFO, is at the same distance from the camera as that tree limb or that house or something, in which case the size of it and what the observer says the size of it were disagree. And one can see that, in fact, it was perhaps a model hung from some branches of a tree or a frisbee thrown out at the right distance and photographed. And although the person claims it was 50 feet across and a couple hundred feet away, in fact, it was only a foot across and just a few feet away. So it is often possible to check things there. Naturally, if the original negatives are provided, one can also check for examples of retouching or things of that variety. Again, not 100% perfect, but it is possible by these means to eliminate most sorts of things that are natural phenomena that are relatively well understood or real frauds. Now, after an attempt is made to go through these sorts of things, what sort of results do we find? Well, the Project Blue Book cases, the cases which the U.S. Air Force studied from 1947 until they closed down their project in 1969, include over 12,000 cases, 12,000 reports. Most of these were shown to be objects which could be identified or for which reasonable explanations could be given. Most of these, by the way, are reports of what we would call low strangeness. I'll explain strangeness more in a few minutes. But basically, they're the sort of things, lights in the sky or some kind of an odd object in the sky at some distance, that there's a good chance of some kind of misidentification. Out of the 12,000, only about 600 could the investigators of Project Blue Book not find anything they thought a reasonable explanation of the thing. So about 4 or 5% of the cases in Blue Book were all that were left after all of this investigation went on. And yet, even some of the other 96%, there have been some investigators who thought that the Project Blue Book people worked rather hard to suggest explanations where ones were really not very reasonable, though you couldn't say they were absolutely impossible. But that's basically the situation. Project Blue Book, mostly identified for offline objects, mostly of low strangeness, and the result was that of their 12,000, they had only about 600 unidentified, 4 or 5%. Since Project Blue Book has been closed, Alan Hynek has opened a data bank in connection with the Center for UFO Studies at Evanston, and this computer data bank is called UFOCAT. UFO catalog is what it's abbreviation for. And he included in that all of the information that Blue Book would allow published, which is these over 12,000 cases, which are now in the U.S. archives. These were also put into the UFOCAT. In addition, other reports that came in since the center has been organized and other reports that they could get their hands on. The UFOCAT data bank contains over 56,000 reports running through 1976. And they have tried, by and large, not to record cases that are obviously IFOs of various sorts. So they've done a little bit of work on the things as they come in. Plus, in many cases, they have done a rather detailed examination. Where the reports come from outside the U.S., they have, for reasons of finances, not been able to investigate these as thoroughly as they would like. But for cases coming in this country, the Center for UFO Studies has a toll-free number that they can not only have people call in, but they can call out and interview people in the area, interview people like air traffic controllers and local weather stations and the persons who made the report and cross-examine them. And as well, they are able, by volunteer help from a group, the Mutual UFO Network, who has individual investigators in the area, to often go personally talk to people as well. They're able then to cut down a number of their entries before they even come in. So the 56,000 in the UFOCAT represents actually much more than just five times as many cases as Blue Book, since the Blue Book are all the reports that came in, not just those that were identified. In the UFOCAT, there is doubtless still many IFOs that they did not have enough money to detect. They're not able to spend the time and money on it to be sure. But they do find that there are many, many cases of what we call high strangeness. About 18 to 20% of the cases in UFOCAT are of high strangeness. And these, I think you can say, certainly this, they are not misidentified known physical phenomena. They must either be frauds or something more to the UFOs. Generally, reports coming into the center, they find that they are unable to identify about 10% of the reported cases when they're able to spend substantial time and effort doing so. So the feeling there at the Center for UFO Studies is there is a real phenomenon that is not merely hoaxing and trivial misidentification of phenomena. There is really something going on. That does not answer for you whether it might be hallucination or mass hallucination or things of that variety, but it does suggest that we're not merely talking about a phenomenon that completely evaporates when it's studied with great care. Rather, there appears to be this residue in the vicinity of 10% of cases. And the general feeling of investigators is that if the average person's understood science a little bit better, the fraction of cases that would be real would be higher, even though the number of cases would be rather smaller, perhaps. Now, before we go further in our discussing UFO reports and such, we will not, by the way, be getting into anecdotes of individual reports. Very interesting things, but quite a lot of literature in the area. We should say a word about the classification scheme. Dr. Hynek at the center has developed a classification scheme which is fairly widely used today, dividing the reports into six categories on the basis of how this UFO appeared. There are three schemes for objects seen at a distance, and three schemes for objects seen nearby, or three categories for objects seen nearby. The three distant object categories are nocturnal lights, an event in which only a light or lights are seen, and they're moving around or something of that variety, but one is not close enough or the illumination is not good enough to tell what the thing would look like in broad daylight or something of that sort. You see the lights in the sky. That would be considered something of rather low strangeness, as you might guess. The second of these sort of distant classifications would be the daylight disk. Here is an object seen in daylight. It does not have to actually be disc-shaped, but that's a rather common shape, so that's how the name got started. Daylight disk has a little ring to it or something of that sort. These would be the so-called classical flying saucer, something that looks like a saucer, though in fact cigar shapes, banana shapes, and sphere shapes and other things of that sort have also been suggested. But all of those come under the category of what we call daylight disk. Seen close enough that it has a shape, you can see what the shape is, seen in daylight, so it's not just a light, but basically a visual observation at some distance. The third classification scheme for objects when they're not close by is the so-called radar or radar visual observation. There have been a number of cases where something has been seen on a radar screen and then either has or has not been visually observed as well. Those observations of UFOs or UFO reports that take that form are classed as radar or radar visual. The higher strangeness cases are those where an object is seen nearby. And these all go under the broad scheme close encounters. And then the three categories are close encounters of the first kind, close encounters of the second kind, and as you might guess, close encounters of the third kind. You doubtless have heard of the film which is circulating by that name. Well, what are these? Close encounters of the first kind are objects seen only a few hundred feet away. The observer, or at least the prime observer, is within just a few hundred feet of the object. Therefore, nocturnal lights, daylight disk, and radar visual are all seen further off distances than that. A few thousand feet, a mile, a few miles, something of that variety. So a close encounter of the first kind is only a visual observation, seen a few hundred feet away. Close encounter of the second kind is not only an object which is seen a few hundred feet away, but after the object has left, or while the object is there, it leaves some kind of a physical trace. The physical trace most commonly takes the form of some kind of depressions in the ground, if it was supposed to have landed, or a burnt mark on the ground where it has done something to the ground or to the plants or something of that sort. However, also included in the close encounters of the second kind are observations of UFOs at rather close range, which involve a disturbance of telephone transmission, a disturbance of electrical power, or a disturbance of automobile engines, disturbance in the ignition system. These are called usually EM type close encounters of the second kind, electromagnetic traces. So physical traces of depressions, physical traces of burnt or withered plant materials, physical traces of electromagnetic type. I suppose also under this category would be those situations where panic is induced in animals, things of this variety. There are definitely reports of that kind. The last category is close encounters of the third kind, and these are encounters in which not only the object itself is observed within a few hundred feet, but some sort of beings, creatures, are observed, which, whether or not one has any reason to believe, are associated with the UFO, they're observed at the same time or near the same time, something of that variety. Creatures which one would presume are the inhabitants or pilots or something of that variety of these vehicles. So that's a classification scheme. Obviously, one will then want to try and take the reports, categorize them into these, and then investigate those that would seem most promising in regard to giving some answers to what are these things, are they real, what is really going on. For investigating these, Dr. Hynek has developed two parameters, numbers you might say, that we could assign to reports. One of these is strangeness, and basically this is a measure of how unusual a report seems. If the report seems not very unusual, it's given a low strangeness number. If it seems very unusual, it's given a high strangeness number. So, for instance, a light in the night sky would normally not be given a very high number at all, unless it moves in a very, very erratic way that does not seem to fit airplanes, shooting stars, or balloons or things of that variety, then it might be given a somewhat higher number. But still, likely, lights in the night sky are going to have very, very strangeness numbers. On the other hand, a close encounter, or particularly seeing a nearby craft with beings walking around, would have a very, very high strangeness number. Not the sort of thing that one would expect out walking one night. So strangeness is one measure. The other measure is a measure of probability. And basically, this is not a measure of how likely does it seem to you, in which case it would just be the reverse of strangeness, but it is a measure of a more neutral question: how well attested is the report? Is the witness or are the witnesses credible? Are they persons who are known to be frauds? Are they persons who are crackpots? Are they persons who are mentally incompetent? Are they persons who are very honest and have a good reputation for that? Are they persons who have training who might be expected to be able to tell the difference between an airliner and something else? How many witnesses are there? Those sort of things are put together to give a probability number. The higher the probability, one would say, other things being equal, the more likelihood that this is something that really happened and not merely the figment of someone's imagination. Well, then naturally, investigators will want to concentrate on events of high strangeness, which are least likely to be misunderstood natural phenomena. The planet Venus will not be mistaken for a landed UFO 200 feet away with creatures wandering around, you understand, nor will swamp gas. So it gets tricky to explain those except by hoax. But an investigation would seek to concentrate not only on high strangeness, but on high probability situations, the ones that are multiply attested, ones that were seen for some duration of time, ones in which the witnesses seem to be otherwise credible. Well, when we examine then these reports that we have in UFOCAT and in Blue Book, we find that the percentage of high strangeness reports in UFOCAT is about three times as high as that in Blue Book. About 18% of the reports in UFOCAT are of high strangeness, whereas only about 6% of those in Blue Book are of high strangeness. One may argue, well, this indicates that the Air Force was more careful, or this indicates that the UFOCAT group is made up of crackpots or something of that variety. But I think the most likely explanation there would be that it's not that, and it's not necessarily that since the UFOCAT has got more recent reports, many of its reports are since 69 to present, whereas Blue Book stops at 69, that necessarily the reports are getting stranger as time goes on, though admittedly UFO magazines are much more reluctant and newspapers are much more reluctant to publish something about a few lights in the night sky, whereas that was quite common in 1947 when the interest in UFOs first began. Rather, it appears in this particular case that at least one factor is that the Blue Book material had to be reported through official U.S. Air Force channels. Therefore, the thing had to come through some chain of command from a local base to make its way over the Blue Book, and there was probably some reluctance to pass on stuff that sounded to them rather strange. So, indeed, Blue Book consists largely of rather low strangeness cases. This shows up far more strongly when we look at the one particular example of high strangeness cases, close encounters of the third kind. A claim to have seen a vehicle within a few hundred feet and to have seen some creatures of some variety. There, the examples in UFOCAT run about 4%, whereas the examples in Blue Book are 0.1%. Out of 12,000 cases, there are only about a dozen cases that fall in this category. Again, it looks very much like it's a situation where no person in the Air Force really wanted to be questioned about whether he really saw something that strange or not, and people were rather reluctant to pass it along the line to Blue Book headquarters as well. In any case, there is this distinction. The UFOCAT, done by men who have as good scientific credentials as the men who did Blue Book, but not working with the Air Force, which, as Hynek points out, had a definite stake to say that there was nothing going on as soon as it became clear to them that it was not a matter of the Russians having some kind of special devices that they were testing out that would be a danger to national security. They tended pretty much to play the whole thing down. Hynek, in his own background, was the scientific consultant for Project Blue Book, and as he originally got into the thing, he thought that most of the stuff was misidentified, natural objects, crackpots, and things of that variety. But as he began to investigate the phenomena, as he began to seek natural explanations for these phenomena, he came face to face with the fact that, at least to him, there did not seem to be reasonable explanations for many of these. And these were not crackpots that were reporting these things to him, but in many, many cases, he was seeing very sober persons, often highly trained in the scientific areas, making reports and sticking by their reports, even though it cost them a great deal of ridicule, and even though many of them pointed out on a number of occasions that they would just as soon this had never happened to them. So I think we should see that Project Blue Book, which was re-examined by a special U.S. commission headed by Professor Condon, a physicist at University of Colorado, seems to have played down the full nature of the phenomena we have here. Continuing on in our discussion of the material that we now have in Blue Book and UFOCAT, we should examine some statistics which will help us to get a little feel for what's going on here. In about 24,000 of the cases available in UFOCAT, there is information available on how many witnesses observe this phenomenon. Naturally, some come from sources that you can't tell, a newspaper report or something, and there's not enough information to tell. But those that, about half of their material, they have records on how many witnesses saw this particular phenomenon. And it's rather interesting to get a feel for that to see what's going on. About 37% of these 24,000 reports, there was only one witness to the event. So one could say, well, it's a hoax by one fella, even though he seems to be normally reliable, he suddenly decided he'd see if he could put one over. Or it's a hallucination. The fellow is sincere, but he really had something happen inside his mind. Nothing was going on out there. A variety. However, that gets rather more difficult when you realize that with 37 of them percent are only one witness, the other 63% then are multiple witnesses. There are no reports of which there were no witnesses. So the other 63% are multiple. 21% of these are two witness cases, and 42% are three or more witnesses. Well, in your more rigorous sort of legal investigations, there's a necessity to have two witnesses or more to be able to cross-examine them and such in order to determine that a person is guilty of a certain crime or things of that variety. So we have to say that, in a sense, a substantial fraction of these 24,000 cases are situations in which there are multiple witnesses for the thing. Therefore, it has to be not merely a hoax, but a fraud of a plot type, or it has to be seen as a multiple hallucination for which psychologists have not, in general, been able to come up with good explanations or even good examples of mass hallucination. Well, it has also been pointed out that very few of the UFO reports at either Project Blue Book or UFOCAT were made by crackpots or mental incompetence, something that can be checked out very easily when you interview persons and find out what their reputation is in their community, things of that variety. So we're not discussing one or two cases that have been blown all out of proportion in the newspapers over the time since 1947. We're discussing what represent at least many thousands of cases. And of these, many of them are multiply witnessed cases. Now, as we move from the whole class of cases over to the cases for high strangeness, we should ask ourselves, do the high strangeness cases suddenly all become one witness situations? You know, well, maybe lights in the night sky several people have seen, but when you get down to close, within 500 feet of the object, or a situation where there are physical traces left, or a creature seen, is it just a matter of one witness to the object? And I think we do have to say that as the strangeness goes up, the number of witnesses does tend to go down, but it does not go down to one. Over a quarter of the high strangeness cases have three or more witnesses. So you drop from 42% to 26% for the high strangeness cases. Now, when you come to close encounters, the third kind, the percentage does drop a great deal. There are very few close encounters of the third kind, which there are three or more witnesses, only 4%. But there are still a number of close encounters in which there are two witnesses. So it does appear that the close encounters, particularly of the third kind, where creatures are seen, are rarely seen by large groups because the appearances, or at least alleged appearances, rarely occur in populated situations. They usually occur at odd times, often 2 to 4 a.m. They often occur in remote areas. But even there, there are still a substantial number of two witnesses cases. When we look through the statistics of the UFO cat to look at the sex of the witnesses, again, we don't have information for all of the cases, but for those where we do, we find that men outnumber women 3 to 1. And it is regularly thought by many people, though I'm sure women are not enthusiastic about this idea, that women are more gullible or something of that variety. It is true that there are more women in various types of cults in general, and there are more women in many types of evangelical denominations, and rationalists say on that basis, well, that's just because women believe things easily, things of that sort. But when you actually look at the situation with regard to UFO reports, there are three times as many reports by men as by women. We don't know whether this is an indication that more men see them, but it's certainly clear that more men report them. It may be a matter of more men being outdoors. UFOs are not known to appear indoors very frequently. But whatever it is, that is actually a fact with the statistics available in this data bank at Evanston. What about the duration of the sightings? Well, for the low strangeness cases, there are often cases where the appearance is of a very short order, under a minute. I think about 39% of your low strangeness cases in UFOCAT run under a minute. But even so, that means 60-61% of the cases run over a minute, a rather substantial length of time to look at what's going on. With the high strangeness cases, the appearances run longer. The largest class among the classes which were arbitrarily chosen to work out the time of appearance is those that last 5 to 14 minutes. 29% of the high strangeness cases last 5 to 14 minutes. And a large number, I think probably nearly 50%, last even longer than that. So the high strangeness cases do have long period occurrences. It basically means that in the high strangeness cases, one is going to be forced to say that if there's nothing there, these are all either hoaxes or hallucinations. It is not easy to say for the high strangeness cases that you were talking about a matter of misidentified natural phenomena. A person that close for that long with multiple witness situation can't very well be mistaken on some simple natural phenomena. The time distribution of these occurrences, the peak is normally in the middle evening, 8 to 10 p.m. if you actually do a time distribution of all the reports. That is probably a phenomena of men, of people's sleeping habits more than a phenomena of when they actually occur. At least it's certainly possible if you would really have to try and correct that for some kind of a diagram in which you have a number of people or a percentage of people who are awake at various hours and put it against that. I think it's fair to say that it does indicate that most of the observations are in the evening, at night, rather than in the daytime. That's pretty clear, because more people are awake in the daytime than are awake at night. But it's the part of the night when people are still awake and when people are still often out traveling around that the peak occurs. For close encounters of the third kind, however, there is a second peak in the early morning, 2 to 4 a.m. And that does seem to be real, because, in fact, that's a time when there aren't many people awake. We see here in the close encounters of the third kind something that's rather striking, and that is the appearances appear to be isolated in time. They appear to be isolated in space. I think that can be said not only for the close encounters of the third kind, but for close encounters in general, and in fact, even for all UFO reports. One of the striking things about UFO reports, and a reason why many people deny that there's anything to them, is that they are not normally seen by very large groups, and there have not normally been what we might call unquestionably public appearances. There have been no UFOs land on the White House lawn with delegates get out to go talk to President Carter or things of that variety. Those things have not happened, and the explanation for that might be that they don't exist. and therefore it's hard to put in public appearances. But there might be other explanations available that whatever these are, they do not want to appear in a public way. And that should be taken into account, at least as a possibility. Calendar-wise, we find that the most frequent month in which UFO reports are made is July, and that's, of course, just what we would expect, perhaps, for the Northern Hemisphere. It's the middle of summer. People are outdoors at night and more likely to see things. What's rather strange is that's also the greatest month for the Southern Hemisphere, when it happens to be the middle of winter. And what that's worth, it's difficult to judge. Well, one can find many more details than what I have given, as well as a narration of various important sightings, in a number of books. Two books I would recommend for your perusal, if you are interested in pursuing this further, is one by Carl Sagan and a fellow named Page, called The UFO Debate. This particular work is interesting in that it presents material both by, it's material by scientists, totally, both by scientists who believe there's something to it, and by scientists who believe there's nothing to it. I've read over the material rather carefully myself, and I don't have any particular predispositions one way or the other. My understanding of Christianity is that we could get along perfectly well with or without the UFOs being any real phenomenon. But having read over the material, I would still have to say that those who think there's purely a phenomenon of the mind, or purely hoaxes, or purely misidentified natural phenomena, or some combination thereof, do not have the better case at the present time. That's my opinion, and I may be wrong. I'm not a UFO investigator myself, but you would have to read that particular work for yourself. Alan Hynek's book, The UFO Experience, is one of the most sober presentations of the material, and well-documented, and a good number of narrations and anecdotes regarding various sightings that have occurred. If you're interested in getting an audio-visual of some sort on this material, the audio-visual from which I have condensed some of this material was prepared by Alan Hynek for Edmund Scientific Company in New Jersey. And you could certainly write them in Barrington, New Jersey, and they would send you the list of the titles of these three short audio visuals by Alan Hynek and the current prices for them. Well, that completes our discussion of what we might call secular studies of UFO reports. There's certainly a disagreement among people who have investigated these things on whether there's something going on or not, but I think the stronger case has been made by those who believe there's something to it, that one has to have very widespread lying of a sort that does not fit in with the personalities or even anything to the advantage of many of the witnesses involved. Many of the witnesses involved have lost their reputation in a community because they found these things, or they had a very good one before. They've gained nothing out of it that they wanted. They have been very unhappy about the notoriety and things of that variety. I think there's something really to this. Having looked briefly at what we might call secular studies of the UFO phenomenon, we want to try and turn to a Christian response to this matter. I've been asked a number of times whether I've ever seen a UFO, and the answer is no, not really. I did see a building down at Harvey Cedars, New Jersey, which one might mistake for a UFO if it were flying through the sky, but since it was sitting on a foundation and had wash hanging out on the line next to it and such, I'm rather well satisfied that it was not the real thing. I believe when I was younger I dreamed about a UFO once, even in Technicolor as I recall, but to the best of my knowledge I have never seen anything. I have seen things in the sky that I couldn't identify, you have to admit that, understand that, but nothing that I really had any reason to believe was UFO. Before we advance to our discussion of Christian response to this, let me say a word or two more about the whole matter of UFOs and their relationship to a study that is becoming rather popular in scientific circles, and that is the question of life on other planets. Certainly the question whether or not we're the only intelligent life in the universe, or whether we're the only intelligent life in our galaxy, has normally been answered, no, we're not the only intelligent life in our galaxy. There must be intelligent life elsewhere. Maybe it's even very common. There are many, many scientists who think that is the case, And a number of these scientists have been able to get money, funding, for various studies in that direction. For instance, there are now a large number of college courses on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Something like 20 or 30 colleges these days are offering courses in that particular area. Likewise, meetings are being held. There were something like a dozen meetings, more or less scientific meetings, that is, the participants were people with scientific credentials, on the question of extraterrestrial intelligence in the year 1979. A number of books have been written on the subject. One of the most famous is Intelligent Life in the Universe by Schlafsky and Sagan. Carl Sagan's book, Communication with Extraterrestrial Intelligence, is a group of articles on the subject of extraterrestrial intelligence and how we can communicate with them or how we can receive communications from them. Several of the spacecraft that have been sent out from the Earth have carried with them messages in case they should be intercepted at some time in their history by intelligent life. One of the Pioneer vehicles sent out past Jupiter and Saturn and then to go out of the solar system has a disc on it, sounds, and I believe also pictures. You would need equipment to decipher it that tell about life on Earth and intended to communicate with intelligent life should it come in contact with it at any place along its course in the next millions of years. Likewise, a study group under federal financing discussed the possibility that the federal government would get into a project called Cyclops, where they would seek to build a huge, what we might call, radio eye. One big huge eye, that's why it gets the name Cyclops, as you can guess, to look out into space for extraterrestrial intelligence. The idea basically was to build an enormous array about 20 miles across of the largest sort of radio telescopes that would be financially feasible. Thousands of them in an array, about 20 by 20 miles, which would have cost several billion dollars. The idea would be that this would be done slowly over the course of many years and would gradually produce an instrument that would be very valuable for radio astronomy as well as very valuable for searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. I rather doubt that such a project will ever get the kind of funding to spend several billion dollars on something like this. But I think it shows us that there is a widespread feeling among scientists, not a majority opinion, I don't think, but a widespread opinion among many scientists, many influential scientists, that there is intelligent life out there, and that if we build the right kind of equipment, we can contact it. What's rather interesting, then, is that in view of this, that many of these same people are very adamantly opposed to the idea that UFOs are extraterrestrial intelligences or the vehicles made by extraterrestrial intelligence. We have the situation where in scientific circles there is a tendency to view UFO studies and stuff as rather fringe activity and not really scientific, even though there's a strong belief that there is intelligent life out in the universe and it should be possible to communicate with it in some way. Why is it that this rather strange bifurcation or paradox or something exists in the scientific mind? On the one hand, accepting the idea of intelligent life, having accepted the idea of evolution and seeing all the planets that at least theoretically exist, and on the other hand, denying that actual UFO reports represent contact with these beings. Well, I think it's not too hard to explain this. It's discussed in Sagan and Page, the UFOs, a scientific debate, which we mentioned earlier. They point out that a calculation has been made by scientists trying to predict how frequent intelligent civilizations ought to be in the universe. This formula basically tries to estimate, first, how many planets there are likely to be, and then what fraction of those planets life would have arisen on, and what fraction of those planets life would have reached a level equivalent to mankind, and on what fraction of those planets life would have reached a level to be able to travel in space and things of this variety, and try and come up with some sort of calculation of how many civilizations ought to exist that could communicate with us. And basically, we find that the estimates range quite a bit. on how likely it is. The pessimistic view of the matter is that the number of such civilizations are so small that the distance between them is so great that we are basically alone in the universe. Maybe not the only intelligent civilization in the universe, but the distance is so great that there could be no real communication. You're talking about thousands or maybe even millions of years that there would take for a message to travel back and forth, and it's hard to have a very lively conversation at that rate. A reasonable estimate is felt that there might be something like 10,000 of these civilizations in our galaxy, and a optimistic estimate is that there might be something like 1 million such civilizations in our galaxy. Well, if 1 million civilizations, they would only be a couple hundred light years apart, so that you could transmit messages back and forth with a delay time of 400 or 500 years, and perhaps communication would be possible. And, of course, if someone could solve the problem of how to travel faster than light, maybe you could even travel back and forth between these particular civilizations. Well, those are considered by evolutionists the optimistic numbers for the number of such civilizations in our galaxy. We've got 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and estimated that only 1 million of those would have, even by an optimistic estimate, would have an advanced civilization capable of communication with us. Well, then basically what is done is to ask, well, is there anything special about the Earth? Well, if there are that many civilizations, and if there are that many other civilizations growing that might eventually reach that, then no, the Earth is not a particularly special place. And so for communication to occur, it's either going to occur totally accidentally, or there's going to be an awful lot of space vehicles being sent out in order to get vehicles here. And basically what Carl Sagan does is he says, well, look, we've got 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and there seem to be something like maybe 10 billion interesting places to visit in the galaxy. After all, there are 10 times that many stars at least, maybe 20 times that many stars. And would presume around every 10th or 20th star there might be a planet that would be interesting to check out. So what you're really saying is that if there are only 1 million civilizations, and they've got to visit 10 billion different places to look around on, then for even one UFO to arrive here a year, one vehicle to come here a year, from all of those civilizations put together, they're going to have to send out about 10,000 launches per civilization per year. You've got 1 million of these civilizations, and if they send out 10,000 launches per year, there'll be a total of 10 billion launches, or one for each of the interesting places in the galaxy. Sagan says, rather tongue-in-cheek, on page 269 of this book, UFOs, A Scientific Debate, this seems excessive to expect that any civilization could afford to send out 10,000 such launches, which have got to use enormous amounts of energy per year just to look around to see whether there's anything interesting to see. So basically on that one calculation, Sagan suggests that it's very unlikely that even one of the UFO reports per year could really be accounted for by a visit from extraterrestrial civilizations of a high order. This is not to deal with other problems which scientists have found very serious, the problem of energy for interstellar travel. The only ways we know of traveling across from one star to another is going to involve enormous amounts of energy, far more energy than our whole world uses for just the one trip. You're talking about things that, at least as far as we can understand, it would seem to be insuperable. Now, of course, it may be that a very advanced civilization would find an easy solution to some of these things. One person, in fact, in our own society, had suggested a huge, what he called, interstellar ramjet, a thing with a big mouth several miles across, and as it travels through space, it collects up all the matter that comes in this mouth, and it runs it through a nuclear engine that turns all of that energy into matter and shoots out the back end, the exhaust or something like this, and showed that there might be a way of making something like this energetically feasible for traveling from civilization to civilization. I think what we'd have to say is we don't know for sure that such things are insuperable, but at least it seems very unlikely. And therefore, scientists, who are usually rather conservative in this area, feel that a extraterrestrial explanation for the UFOs, the idea that the UFOs are vehicles traveling from some other world out there many light years away are not really reasonable explanations. And as a result, they having no other explanation then but misidentification, fraud, or hallucinations, that is a direction they tend to go. However, from a Christian perspective, I think we can suggest one other rather important explanation that solves some of these problems, and yet it is something which scientists, as a rule, not accepting the supernatural and such, are not willing to consider. This particular suggestion appears in a number of Christian works on UFOs. Probably one of the best works that has been done in this area, though it's rather short, is the August 1977 edition of the SCP Journal. The SCP is the Spiritual Counterfeits Project, a Christian organization out in California, which seeks to deal with cults and the occult, things of that variety. They devoted a whole issue to UFOs with the title UFOs, Is Science Fiction Coming True? And what was pointed out in one of their articles is basically the view that there are extraterrestrial intelligences in space, and that these beings will have, by their great civilization, solved all of the problems that we face in life that we can't solve, namely how to get along with one another, how to avoid having a nuclear holocaust that will destroy us, how to provide food and happiness and things, and how perhaps even to solve the problem of death. Basically, the writer there in the SCP Journal suggests that what these people are doing is they're drawing spiritual conclusions, so to speak, without spiritual terminology. They're talking the same sort of things that the Bible is telling you how are to be solved. They're believing that these civilizations have solved that, but they're avoiding all of the spiritual terminology. And it's of some interest that there are groups which claim to have been taken aboard spaceships and things of that variety. Some of your close encounter stories and some others which show up in occult circles of a UFO sort that have these same sort of explanations, the kind of explanations that once used to be explained in terms of spirit visitors from the beyond the grave and such, but they're giving the same kind of explanation. They're giving explanations of how everything will be all right, but it's all done by technology. It's interesting, however, that not merely persons like Christians who are writing on the subject of UFOs have noticed a resemblance between occult phenomena and UFO phenomena. Alan Hynek, in his book, The UFO Experience, points out on page 188 that the UFO problem belongs to, he says, the physicist, the sociologist, the psychologist, and even the student of the occult. So he concedes that there is some interest here in circles where there is a study of occult subjects. The senior bibliographer at the Library of Congress, Lynn Cato, was asked to prepare a bibliography on the UFO phenomenon for the Air Force some years ago. And as she worked over the material, she pointed out something in preparing this bibliography, that many of the UFO reports now being published, she said, in the popular press recount alleged incidents that are strikingly similar to demonic possession and psychic phenomena which have long been known to theologians and parapsychologists. So here's a person who, as far as I know, has no Christian background or things of that sort, but a person who had to read through hundreds and hundreds of articles on UFOs and noted that the kind of phenomena occurring there are very similar to the kind of phenomena that occur in demonic possession. It's also been noted that there is a rather strange variety that exists in UFO phenomena. We think of the fact that the UFOs themselves take various shapes. We will see saucer shapes, we will see spherical shapes, we'll see cigar shapes, we'll see banana shapes, we'll see sometimes saucer shapes with little points on the top or saucer shapes with antennas around the ridge, etc. Now, see, although they fall into maybe four or five major categories, there are dozens of variations within these. And one might say, well, we're looking at a fleet which has quite a variety of vehicles or something of that variety. You notice also that among reports of what the little creatures look like, they tend to fall into two or three categories,
But within the categories, there's an enormous amount of differences of opinion of what these things look like. You tend to get the little squat, big-headed beings, but otherwise, the description is quite various. You get the rather humanoid beings, same size, shape, head size, etc., as man, but they've got a lot of variety in them. And then you get things that we might think of as robots or something, and there's a lot of variety among the reports there. You wonder, what kind of phenomena are we looking at? There's an awful lot of variety here. And those who deny that there's anything to it say you're looking at human imagination. And human imagination is capable of all this variety. For those who say that they're really visitors from outer space, there's a problem of quite a menagerie here. And notwithstanding the menageries that you may see in Star Wars and things of that variety, one would expect to see the same kind of creatures rather frequently if this is being worked by one or two planets, something of that variety. What is not perhaps quite so well known is that there are apparent UFO appearances from earlier periods which take quite different appearances. For instance, in 1896, there appears to have been a UFO flap over the United States, and a report of this appears in the San Francisco Call in November of 1896. I don't have the exact date of that particular paper for you. but what was reported there is an airship, that is presumably a balloon with propellers, etc., on it, was seen by many people across the country. Yet its appearance and disappearance, in a sense, would fit that of UFOs. And the people aboard were singing a Christian hymn, a rather strange sort of thing. But as best could be told, there was no one who knew of such an airship that was actually had set out from anywhere in the U.S. or anything of that variety. In other words, it had some of the phenomena the same, isolated in location and in time and things of that variety. But its appearance was an appearance in terms of things that people could visualize or understand or something in 1896. And so that type of phenomena would suggest that we are either dealing with imagination, fraud, something, or we're dealing with something that is like the occult that can change its form depending upon the observer. This is a characteristic of occult phenomena, that appearances may not be the same for everybody that even sees it. A recent article appeared in Science News, February 17, 1979, discussing the question of whether the close encounters that were reported in UFO literature, whether or not they might all be imagination. The title of the object was Close Encounters, All in the Mind. And it was pointed out in this article that the abductees have experiences similar to the type of experiences which are had by people who are having drug hallucinations and people who are having so-called near-death experiences. I don't know whether you have read any of the literature of near-death experiences, Life After Life by Moody, various works by Kubler-Ross, but it is something that has become rather popular recently, the idea that somehow people have an insight into unseen things on the basis of experiences that have occurred when they were very near death. Basically, the article points out that because the experiences of UFO abductees are similar to those with drug hallucinations and with near-death experiences, then it must be that all of this thing is imagined. Basically, we find two different solutions have been given to this, and both of these solutions appear in the Science News article. On the one hand, people say this is all an imagination or a hallucination of some variety, and for imagination or hallucination, basically, those who think that that is not a satisfactory explanation point to the fact that the character of the witnesses is such that it does not seem to be hoaxed, and there are not people who have been known to have hallucinations before. So there's sort of these isolated single events that really make a difference in their life, and the character of the witnesses are such that if you were judging anything else, you would think that they were really reporting what had happened. Likewise, in answer to this whole suggestion of imagination, it was pointed out that there's the problem of multiple attestation, that you have several people who have seen the same phenomena at the same time. And there, the psychologist who denies there's anything has to bring up the idea of multiple hallucination for which no one has ever been able to show there's good evidence that such a thing exists. The problem of the time length of the appearances is likewise a rather serious matter. You might be interested in what kind of phenomena these are that find similarities in drug hallucinations and near-death experience. Well, we find that one of these are funny sounds, humming sounds. One of them is the feeling that one is floating out of one's own body, or at least floating. The idea that the person is moving through a tunnel or a tube and approaching a door or a border, encountering some kind of being, sometimes haloed, sometimes floating, having telepathic communication with the being, seeing perhaps a rapid review of events, like viewing the person's life on a witness screen. That's rather common in near-death experience. Undergoing an examination of some variety, usually a physical nature or a moral in nature in the case of near-death experiences. And perhaps receiving a message of some sort to give to those when you go back, and then returning back to the normal life surroundings. A rather popular explanation that has been proposed for all of these phenomena is that in each of these cases, the person is reliving their birth experience, that they are passing through a tunnel, namely the birth canal, and they are coming into a light and floating, and they're having a physical examination, doctor, things of that variety. The biggest problem that you have here is that some of the phenomena do not fit that, the receiving a message, telepathic communication, being sent back, and things of that variety. Those don't fit very well at all. But when one feels that, well, there's something only purely natural to this, and it's not an extraterrestrial phenomenon, then doubtless this is the kind of explanation that is going to be proposed. A physicist by the name of James McCampbell has assembled a group of effects which are characteristics of UFOs, and it's interesting that a number of these resemble occult phenomena as well. Some of these, by the way, do not fit or go beyond those that are explained as fitting hallucinations and those that would fit a birth experience in any way. For instance, the atmospheric effects that often associate UFO phenomena, the surrounding clouds, the colored halos, dazzling brightness, luminous tails, lingering clouds, things of that variety. The dazzling brightness might be thought to fit a birth experience, but the others don't really fit at all well. The landing sites with pungent odors, baked earth, charred organic matter, shriveled materials, things of that variety, they're real phenomena. And one has to say that that isn't somebody's remembrance of his birth. Maybe they're all hoaxes, though some of them are a rather strange sort, but they do fit the kind of phenomena that occur occasionally in occult experience. Demonic phenomena is often associated with strange odors, and with things like baking or charring or damaging of vegetation and things of that variety. So that, I think, is one area that's of rather significant interest. Likewise, the other physical phenomena that are associated with close encounters of the second kind, the interruption of the operation of gasoline engines, the situation where you have heat and light occurring, the situation where there's interference with radio and television or power transmission. These areas are examples of physical phenomena that are regularly reported, and they resemble certain sorts of phenomena associated with occult, but they don't resemble anything associated with birth. And again, this would have to be something that one just says, this is the imagination of a person, or this is to be dismissed as hoaxing, something of that variety. Animal panic is also mentioned as a phenomenon that occurs here. And that itself reminds us that the occult is related to that on occasion as well. We may bring to our mind there from the biblical accounts the example in Mark 5, verses 9 through 13, where a demonized person has the demons removed from him. They go into some animals who panic and run down the hill and kill themselves in the water. Basically, what I would like to suggest here is that a rather significant possible explanation has been ignored by those who are secular investigators in this area. The explanations that have been available to secular investigators have basically been, one, misidentified natural phenomena. 2, hoax. 3, visitors from beyond this world. But a fourth explanation would be visitors who are beyond this world in one sense, but not in the normal spatial sense. Not visitors from light years away, but visitors from some other space right around us. An explanation that fits in extremely well with the biblical picture of the demonic and the angelic and such. Beings who occupy an area around us in some way, but not far away. Beings who can come into our space and leave it without having to travel around in our space a great deal. Therefore, their appearances are isolated in time and place. Beings who know enough about man and control themselves enough that they are able to appear more or less how they want to appear, rather than appearing necessarily as they really are. All of these areas fit very well the phenomena of the UFO situation, better than any of the other three alternatives or any combination of the other three alternatives that I have seen presented. Well, I don't think we are in a position today to say that UFOs must unquestionably exist, though I think we can say that at the moment the data that exists would favor an explanation of their existence more than an explanation that they're merely imagination or fraud. I don't think we're in a position to say that they cannot be extraterrestrial beings coming in from many light years away, but the number of these reports and the nature of these reports rather suggest that that does not fit very well. Whereas what little we know about the occult, and I do not recommend anyone get into experimentation in this area to find out more about the occult, is such that does fit in adequately well with this particular area. It brings us to something that is very important, more important perhaps in some way than even knowing for certain exactly what UFOs are, and that is the recognition that the Bible tells us that the occult does exist, that it is not merely fraud and imagination of men, that there are powers which are beyond our own powers, that there are intelligent beings which have these powers, and these intelligent beings can in some way move in and out of our space. We do not know the details of that. And that these beings, at least a whole class of these beings, are in very strong opposition to man and in very strong opposition to God. This biblical picture means we are in a far more dangerous universe than most people are willing to concede we are. We're in a universe that won't just sit there while you experiment on it and calmly give you back the information of what's really going on. We are rather in a universe that in some areas, when you experiment on it, you get back information which intelligent beings want you to have, but not for your own good. There are certainly many features of the UFO phenomena that fit in with this situation, as with the occult. In the occult phenomena, it's been very hard for investigators to be sure anything is really going on, but it's been very hard to prove that the cases are easily explained by merely fraud, deception, or hallucination. I think we see the same picture here in regard to the UFOs. The Bible warns us that there will come a time in the last days when there will be miraculous phenomena going on and there will be attempts to deceive. Matthew chapter 24, verses 23 and 24 warn us of this time. Jesus says, at that time, if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, don't believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and wonders to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. Look, says Jesus, I have told you in advance. We've been warned by the Lord that there are beings with abilities to do things that we would call miraculous, and that there will be times when they will be able to appear in a rather public way and do it, rather than merely so to speak, under the counter. I think we have to say right now that the UFO phenomena is pretty much under the counter so far. There has not been any public landing anywhere. If the biblical picture of the demons and such is a proper view of reality, as I believe it is, and if the UFOs are explained as this, which I believe is the case, but I do not believe nearly as strongly as I believe the Scripture is correct, then we could see how it might be advantageous at some period to appear in such a way as to convince some people of the reality while being slippery enough to allow other people plenty of room to deny the reality of these things, so that one group could remain in a purely non-supernatural worldview and the other group would come into a supernatural worldview, but come into it in such a way that they would understand them to be either extraterrestrial visitors or they would be drawn off into the occult rather than being influenced to investigate Christianity in any serious way. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 9 gives us Paul's prediction of the fact that these miracles that will occur, these supernatural phenomena that will occur, will one day be culminated by the coming of one whom we often call the Antichrist. And this lawless one, as is spoken of in 2 Thessalonians 2:9, he will be able to work with the power of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders. Not apparently counterfeit miracles in the sense that they're not miraculous, but counterfeit in the sense that they don't mean what they claim to mean. Well, that brings us to the real question, are the UFOs real? And I doubt if we can give an answer there that would be satisfactory to everybody. And I think the reason is that in this area, we're dealing with a problem of experimentation in an area where experimentation may not produce totally satisfactory results. Now, to many scientists, to hear that there are such areas would be a scandal. And yet, if you think about it for a moment, there are such areas already in human endeavor. A psychologist may wish to experiment on what you're really like and try to do that by giving you a psychological exam. So he designs an exam with all these questions that are intended to reveal what you're really like, and then he gives it to you. And if he knows what he's doing, and you don't know what he's doing, and you're trying to be honest, or you're trying to lie in certain simple ways, he'll be able to find that out from the test. He'll be able to experiment on you and get results. But if you know as much as he does, and if you know what kind of a picture you want to present to him, then you can do that quite perfectly well. And he's not really experimenting. He is really being fed information you want to feed him. Well, if our picture here in the Scripture of intelligent beings who would like to lead men astray is real, then that's the kind of situation we might very well have here in connection with the UFO phenomena. We're definitely in an area where experimentation is very difficult. You can't bring the thing into the laboratory. You can't repeat it. You're depending upon the statements of witnesses, some of whom are doubtless liars, some of whom are certainly not trained, but they're the ones who allege to have seen these things. They're the ones you have to deal with. We're dealing with things that may not be of a simple, natural sort. Well, I'm not trying to pressure you into believing in UFOs or pressure you into believing the supernatural, but I would like to suggest to you that it is very important that you would carefully consider Christianity, that you would carefully consider the claim that there's a God who created the whole universe, who's responsible for the order that exists in this universe, who's responsible for what we are in the sense that we are well-made, in the sense that we have a moral consciousness in us, and he has designed us to live a certain kind of a life, to live a life of righteousness. But we're in rebellion against him. We don't want to live that kind of life. We want to go our own way. And as a result of that, we're opening ourselves to all sorts of dangerous influences. We're opening ourselves first to a very simple, natural, dangerous influence, and that is the danger of ignoring the instructions given by the one who made us on how we can have real peace and joy and happiness, and trying to replace them by what we want to do, which, as far as we know, may perfectly well produce a complete disaster in our life. We're likewise opening ourselves to more dangerous influences, the deception of supernatural beings, those who would desire to have us either believe there's no God at all, there's no supernatural, or if we believe there's a supernatural, that we would be on his side and not on God's side. I would be very much concerned that if you are interested in UFOs, you not blithely continue on in your studies, presuming that this is visits from beings from outer space, and whatever they say, well, they're smarter than we are, and they're purely neutral, they just want our good, and such, but rather at least consider rather seriously this other alternative. The biblical picture gives us then a very scary universe in one sense. It gives us a universe in which there are beings smarter than we are, more powerful than we are, who are out to deceive us and to turn us away from the truth. And you ask, how can we possibly, in such a universe, avoid getting into a very serious mess? The Bible has an answer for that. The biblical answer is that there's a God who created all of this, who created even these beings, Satan and his demons, who have turned away from him. They're created good, but turned away from him. That God is a God of truth. That God will not mislead you. That God will lead you into a life of real righteousness. What you need to do is get his word. You need to study his word. You need to begin to apply his word to your life. And you will begin to see a transformation taking place in your life as you apply his principles that will show you indeed that these are principles that come from the creator of the universe and not merely principles that some ancients had guessed about as they were writing up books to deceive the untrained. One of the most important messages of God's book is there's something drastically wrong with us. And as we examine our own lifestyle, we begin to see that that's really true. We find again and again that the very things we think people ought not to do, we do them ourselves. We see how people can be selfish and spiteful and dishonest and lazy and angry when they ought not to be. We see all these things in other people, and we judge them for it, but we don't realize that judgment recoils on us. We don't look at ourselves carefully enough to see that we fall that same way. God has told us that we're to love him with all our heart and mind and soul. We were made to do this. This is the way we're going to find our real joy and peace. God's not an egotist. God is merely telling us what is right and what will give us our real peace. He tells us we ought to love God. We ought to love our neighbor as much as ourselves. And we can see how that would work in the society around us, how that would make a pleasant place if everybody cared for others as much as they cared for themselves. What a great place that would be. But we all say, I can't take a chance on it. I'm not going to do that. Someone will run all over me. We're denying that there's a God who created the universe who will protect us. We're denying that there might be better things in life than protection. And it might be better to do what's right, even if we get hurt for it, so to speak, by others. That it's better to do that than it is to do what we want just to make sure that nobody hurts us. Well, God is going to judge us one day for the kind of life we've lived. And all of us are going to fail. Depending on our own abilities, we're going to see that we come short again and again and again and again. God is just. He can't just say, it's all right. You did better than this fellow. You're okay. No. God has got to say, that is sin. It's stupid. It's rebellious. I cannot treat that as though it's all right. But God, though he is just, is also merciful. He has provided a way by which we can be changed so that we will do what he designed us to. How our past actions in not doing what we ought to have done can be paid for. He did that in Jesus Christ. God himself became a man, came to earth, lived a life of complete obedience to God's commands to show us what it was like, but also to provide the righteousness that we aren't providing. If we trust in Jesus, that righteousness is made ours. He also died a horrible death on the cross. Being God, he was able to suffer in a few hours, something that no man could suffer. Being man, he's able to die as a human, and so to pay for human sins. If we trust in Jesus, the sins we ought to pay for, the sins we committed, Jesus has paid for, and we won't have to pay for them. And then if we're trusting in Jesus alone, not depending on our good works, but depending upon him alone, God will change us inside. He'll send his Holy Spirit into us to begin to change us, to begin to become what we ought to be, what we were designed to be, what is the real fulfillment that we've sort of always dreamed we could be, but didn't really understand what we were dreaming about. Well, that's the good news of God's word. And sometimes he has to use the bad news of the things around us, of the dangers in the world around us, to drive us to himself. I pray that the Lord might use some of the things we said in this talk to cause you to come to Jesus Christ and his salvation and his blessing.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.